The today's Teisho is on case 34 in the Hikigan Roku, in the Blue Rock Collection. Case 34 is entitled, Kyozan's You Have Not Visited Rozan. Main subject, Kyozan asked a monk, where are you from? Mount Rozan, answered the monk. Have you ever visited Goroho Peak? Asked Kyozan. No, not yet, said the monk. Kyozan said, You have not visited Rozan. Later, Ulmon said, this talk of Kyozan's was falling into the weeds, all out of kindness. Secho's verse, falling or not falling, who can tell? White clouds piling up, bright sun shining down, faultless the left, mature the right. Don't you know? Kanzan? He went very fast, 10 years not returning. He forgot the way he had come. So, this is a beautiful day, right? Sun is shining. People have come here to practice the way, to practice Zen. We have gotten up early. In the Zendo this morning, there was just this extraordinary stillness. It was really wonderful to see something like this. It's very unusual. This kind of thing is quite unusual. If you think about it, having people who are willing to take time out of their busy lives to engage in a very strenuous process like this. You know, we're meditating 8 or 9 hours a day, getting up early in the morning, this highly structured schedule. And yet, there are 28 people in this room who are doing that, you know. And judging from what I'm hearing in Dokusan, people are pretty happy. This doesn't necessarily match the conventional idea of happiness, you know. So if you said to somebody, I'm going on a retreat, I'm going to take a week off and go on a retreat, or I'm taking a weekend off and I'm going to go on a retreat, they might say, oh, that's wonderful, you know. You know, and maybe they would imagine you're going to drive out into the country and, you know, get up around 8 and come down and there's like a dining hall and you can have a cup of coffee and a blueberry muffin, you know, and then there'll be like seminars, you know, through the day. Finding your true nature, you know. The ins and outs of samadhi, you know. That's, you could take notes, you know. You know, then at the end there'd be a rating form. You know, how did you find the various speakers? You know, oh, they were all wonderful. You know, that's they could be like, some kind of social event at the end, in the evening, like a mixer. You know, so that would be. That would be a more conventional understanding. Or, you know, it would be a Club Med type thing, you know, where we'd have the lectures on samadhi and then it's out on the beach, you know, everybody could hit the beach and, people actually do things like that. You know, there are like yoga, I'm not criticizing because it's wonderful, you know, but there are like yoga gigs where people go to Provence, you know, and they do yoga on the shore, that kind of thing. And they have great dinners and stuff, you know. So, so those are wonderful events. I'm not knocking them, you know. But what we're doing is really different from that. You know, it's not what conventional people would think. You're getting up when, you know, you get how much sleep, you know, you're meditating for 9 hours a day, you know. And they might be astonished if you said, oh yeah, the pain in my legs. By day 3, you know, my legs are just screaming. You know, people would think, what the hell? You know, what is going on, you know, at this place? Right? Oh, my legs, you know. They were screaming with pain. You know. And you stayed? You stayed for the whole thing, you know? But, you know, there's something that happens at Sesshin that's, even though it goes totally against, in some ways, what our major cultural messages are, you know. It can be incredibly liberating, incredibly energizing and purifying, you know. And I think that's quite interesting. And, you know, people come to meditation, the beginners, they sit for half an hour, they have a little break, they sit for another half hour. More than 50% never come back, you know, but a certain percentage of people come back. There's something about this that's gripping. And they come back and they start practicing regularly, and then, you know, they show up on a Wednesday night and they go through the three sits without moving. And then one day they come on a Saturday at 7 o'clock in the morning after like a hard week of work. They get up early, they drive over to Rutgers, they sit down and they go through, you know, a long period, you know, reciting sutras and tea, bathroom break, then three periods with no moving, you know, or very little moving, then a break, and then two more periods, and then a talk, and by the end you've put in a long stretch, you know, 5 hours on the cushion, more or less. And there's something, you know, again, this is just not the conventional idea of a happy Saturday, right? You're supposed to get up on Saturday, it's your day off, you're supposed to take an extra hour of sleep, you know, get up, have a cup of coffee, turn on the radio, start some scrambled eggs, you know, the coffee's brewing, and you turn on NPR, or you read, you know, read the sports news or something, and there's nothing wrong with any of that. I'm not criticizing. But there's something, you know, going on with these Zen people that's different from that. You know, we get up early, you know, we sit motionless for hours, and yet something is very alive about what we do. So much so that, you know, there's a fair number of repeat customers for Sesshin. You know, people keep coming back, and I think that's just fascinating. You know, the cultural messages tend to, I think, center around. I think our culture is pretty much designed to produce, material abundance. I think that's what we're all about. Wealth and comfort, you know. Apparently, the Buddha was a big proponent of life insurance. I never knew that, you know. But there's a scholar named Gregory Chopin, and he's done a lot of work on Buddhist economics. And he has looked at early Buddhist communities, and apparently the Buddha urged his followers to get life insurance, you know. So security is, makes sense, right? I mean, you want to be, if your spouse dies, you want to have everything in order, so... basically, I think life insurance is a good idea too, you know. The point is that, you know, the Buddha thought it was good to have a happy life. You know, he thought it was good to be materially secure. These are the values of our culture. You know, material security, wealth, and the comfort, you know. And there's nothing wrong with being comfortable, you know. I have a comfortable chair I work on when I'm at my word processor, you know. I used to have a bench that I built myself in graduate school, but it was so uncomfortable, after a while I couldn't stand it. You know, I could only, it's hard enough sometimes to sit down and work, so, you know, having a bench that's even, very uncomfortable just gives me all the more reason not to go and sit down and write, you know. So I finally got a comfortable chair. You know, I found other reasons sometime not to sit down and work, you know. But the point is that, you know, we get these messages that are very powerful, and they say, you know, this will make you happy. And yet, you know, sometimes we do all the things that make us happy, and we're not happy, you know. And this is, I think, one of the great puzzles in life, you know, that we can pretty much do what the culture says will make us happy, and yet a lot of the time, or some of the time anyway, we realize we're not happy, you know. And, you know, when I was growing up, I saw that a lot, you know. So my uncle lived here in New Jersey. My uncle's family, I guess, were from Russia, actually. He's my father's sister's husband. And he was the nicest guy, I thought. And he married my father's sister, who grew up in Elizabeth with my dad. And he had gone to the war, you know, he had fought in the war, and came back, and he got a loan from the government, and he opened a gas station. And he made actually like a ton of money at the gas station. And then he got another gas station and another gas station. And pretty soon he had like a bunch of gas stations. And I liked him, John, my Uncle John. He always smoked cigars. And he had many of the conventional hallmarks of a successful person, you know, in the 1960s, you know, when I was a kid. We always had like an older model car. My dad was in the service, so we didn't make a lot of money. And Uncle John always had like a Cadillac, you know. And in those days, that was the prestige car. Now it's like a BMW. And I'm not criticizing owning a BMW. My uncle would have a pretty new Cadillac, and he would trade them in so that they never got too old. And he had a house in Montclair, and basically he was living the life. And I remember going up to see my aunt and uncle in Montclair, and I remember my aunt looking so tired, you know, so tired, and unhappy, you know. Even as a little kid, I could kind of see it. And she was trying to refit. I guess when they bought the house, it was a big, expensive house, and they didn't quite have the money to finish it properly. So my aunt was doing all the staining and varnishing of the woodwork herself. And I think she had some kind of a job, too, you know. So she was raising two kids. She was, you know, basically doing a lot of the woodwork finishing. And my uncle, John, you know, worked like day and night at his gas stations. And he would get up, I think, like at the crack of dawn and start working at his gas stations. And then he'd come back late at night. And over time, you know, my uncle developed like a drinking problem because his life was just so centered around making money and being, you know, running this empire of gas stations. And my aunt, you know, I think she was very frazzled in a lot of ways. And my uncle and aunt were very status conscious. You know, they were living in a community that was really quite wealthy. So they were always concerned that they had a new car. And anyway, you know, you can see where this story is going, you know. They were both nice people. My aunt was a wonderful person, and Johnny was a really nice guy. But they just kind of got caught, you know, following like the instruction manual for a happy life that our society gave them, you know. They eventually got divorced. You know, you can see where this is going. John developed a serious drinking problem, and you know, my aunt couldn't get him to quit, and they got divorced, and they liked each other. You know, they actually got reunited after about 10 years, and then they got divorced again. You know, it just didn't work. You know, and And finally, you know, my uncle had a girlfriend, and my aunt was living somewhere in some community down at the shore after she retired. And, you know, they just didn't know any better. Maybe none of us do. You know, we do what society says we should do. And it is important to be, you know, to be part of a community. You know, we follow what society says because we want to be part of a community. It's very important for our happiness, you know. I have a friend of mine who, she was telling me that her husband, who grew up in a Hispanic family, really decided he didn't want to be a Christian anymore. And he became like militantly anti-Christian. And so, you know, he decided we're not going to celebrate Christmas. No Christmas. You know, that's a Christian holiday. Absolutely no Christmas. And my friend said, you know, but come on, can't we celebrate? No, no Christmas, you know. So they invented their own holiday, you know. Sounds crazy, but, you know, they invented their own holiday. So, you know, basically 100, you know, 200 million people were celebrating Christmas, and they had, you know, Wonka Wonka or whatever, you know, they were celebrating. And they had a Wonka Wonka tree or something, or maybe, you know, something, I don't know. So they were having their own little festival, right? You know, and that just doesn't work, right? It's like, you know, you really can't do it yourself, right? The beauty of a festival, you know, whether it's Diwali or, you know, the High Holy Days or anything else, is that you have other people involved, you know. So that community element is really important, you know, and we do look to other people, you know. Do you think this is, you know, should I buy a new car? You sort of look to other people. What should I do? And so we need community, right? But, you know, sometimes we follow the scripts of our society and we wind up not being very happy, you know. And this is so clearly the case, you know. Because the society is not necessarily designed to produce people who are actually happy. You know, it's got all kinds of motives, you know, making, you know, people want to sell you things, they want you to buy this or that, you know, and they really don't care if you wind up happy or not. They think they'll wind up happy, you know. So you have to, you know, you need to be in a world with other people. You need a community. I mean, we benefit from a community. We all got up together. You couldn't do this by yourself. But sometimes the messages that your society sends you are you're doing everything you're supposed to do and you're not happy, you know. This is really, I think, quite important, you know. You can read books on happiness and you can try to do them and you still might not be happy, you know. I think this is interesting. You know, interesting. You can have the house, you can have the car, you can do all the things you were told, and yet, you know, at the end of the day, you don't feel alive. You might even feel dead. You know, I think a lot of people go through life, they go through the motions, they do what they're supposed to do, and at the end, they don't feel very, very alive, you know. And I was reading something by this psychologist, Daniel Gilbert, and he was saying that people are actually very bad at predicting what will make them happy. You know, so you know, they've done a lot of studies where they'll say, you know, please, you know, estimate, you know, what, you know, estimate. Your level of happiness if this happens. And they all say, oh yes, if this happens, I would definitely be very happy. And then it turns out when that happens, you know, they're not happy. They don't rate themselves, you know, it turns out they're not happy. And sometimes what happens is that, you know, the things you didn't predict or you didn't imagine would make you happy wind up making you very, very happy. You know, that's Gilbert's point. He says that we really can't consciously know what's going to make us happy. you know. And I think that's really quite important, you know. So we try to plan out our lives, right? We try to say, you know, I'm going to start at this point, and in 10 years I'll be here, and I know that if I do all these things, I'll be happy. And there's a lot of evidence that at the end of 10 years, you might not be happy. You know, and it, you plan it out, you think it through, you try to know yourself. You know, we try to know ourselves, but actually, you know, we really can't know ourselves. Isn't that interesting? I think. You know, we really can't know yourself. You know, it's like the self is really like out of view, or it's not. It's like you can't see it. You know, and you might do a certain thing. And think at the end of this, it's going to make you happy. But then you get to that place, and you find, lo and behold, that you guessed wrong. You know. I was reading something about how doctors have rather high rates of job dissatisfaction. And I was stunned, because when I was growing up, I was actually good in science. And my mother wanted me to become a doctor. And she used to beg me to be. She said, just be a doctor, please. She would. And she used to put her hands up in the air, and she just, you know, like her finger pointing, like her, she was raising her hands to heaven, and she said, Kurt, you know, be a doctor. You can write your own ticket, you know. So for me, being a doctor was like, that would be the wisest thing a person could do, you know. And I didn't become a doctor, and my mother, you know, found a way to forgive me. But, you know, I too have this like, oh, they must be terribly happy. And it turns out the studies show doctors aren't terribly happy. They have twice the addiction rate of ordinary people, partly because they're, you know, around drugs, but also because they have a lot of stresses. If you've seen Nurse Jackie, the, you know, wonderful show on nurses too, they, you know, they have, you know, a lot of drug abuse problems, you know, as we know from Nurse Jackie, you know, so. Even doctors aren't happy, it turns out, you know. They did what their mother said, right? They followed mother's advice, they became doctors, and yet not happy, you know. So you know, Zen has a different idea, which is that, you know, really the self is not knowable easily, or probably ultimately, you know. And that if you ask your conscious mind what would make you happy, it will probably rely on what other people told it, you know. So basically, if you ask somebody, you know, what would be the most satisfying job, they'll remember, well, Mom said you should be a doctor, being a doctor, you know. Or, you know, basically, you know, your father might have said there's no higher calling than the life of the learned person, you know. So if I'm a learned person, I will surely be happy, because that's what Dad said, you know. And then you might get there and think, yeah, this is really not for me, you know. So the point is, how do we live then? You know, how do we live if we can't know ourselves, and we can't know what will make us happy by listening to experts, or by sort of introspecting, trying to ask ourselves, well, Kurt, what would make you happy, you know? You really can't know, you know. You think you know, but then you get to that point and you realize, I was totally wrong about myself. I totally misjudged myself, you know. That happens to people all the time, and then they kick themselves in the rear end. They think, wow, what was wrong with me? You know, I totally misjudged myself. You know, I remember seeing this movie a long time ago about this guy who was very unhappy. He and his wife were both in these very, very demanding jobs, and they decided that they would retire early, buy a trailer, you know, and like a one of those, you know, mobile home type things, where, you know, Airstream type thing, you know, where you would, you know, you get in and you drive around. It's like a little house on wheels, and they decided this would be their paradise. And of course, they do it, and they're abjectly miserable. And at the end of the movie, it shows them driving back up to the company where they used to work, and they jump out, and they're back in their suits, and they can't wait to get to their desk. You know? So this is real. This is like, okay. So how do we live if this is the reality, right? We listen to mom and dad, and we love them, they love us, but they don't always know what would make us happy. We read the expert, and we do what the expert says, and yet, you know, we get the medical degree, we become the partner in the law firm, and yet, you know. Zen has this idea that we have access, or we have to find a way to access our, we say, bigger mind or unconscious mind. And Zen is all about learning how to let that unconscious mind guide us in making life decisions, right? So a lot of Zen practice could be understood as learning to have, like you could say, like an intelligent heart, right? An intelligent heart. Most people have like an unintelligent heart, right? You can say to somebody, "How do you feel about this?" "I don't know." It's amazing how people are not able to access something like their own feelings or their own fears or their own desires, because they won't, they don't know how to have an intelligent heart. They're living in the world of consciousness, and they're pursuing what they think they want, but a lot of the time they don't really allow themselves to know how they feel, how they really feel about something. And sometimes people can be hugely unhappy for a long time before they get the news, and the news usually comes in the form of like depression or a substance abuse, right? And it's as though we say, "Oh my God, I didn't realize how unhappy I was." How is that possible? But this happens quite a bit to people, So Zen is about, Zen has many dimensions, but one of them is, accessing the unconscious mind and learning how to trust its instructions, That's a lot of what we're doing on the cushion. We're sitting on the cushion and we want to use the part of the mind that thinks things through, right? So maybe you have a koan like this one. Maybe this is your koan, Where are you from? Mount Rozan. Have you ever visited Goho Peak? Asked Kyozan. No, not yet, asked the monk. Kyozan said, "Well, you have, then you've never been to Rozan." I mean, believe it or not, this koan is really about the big mind, about the unconscious mind. It's like you've been to the place, you say you've been to the place, but did you go to the peak? Are you in touch with your deeper mind? Not yet. He said, "Well, then you haven't been. You haven't gone yet." So this is really all about getting on in touch with this unconscious mind. And the unconscious mind, according to Zen teaching, is hugely reliable, is like hugely trustworthy. The Buddhist belief in general, but as I said the other day, Zen is Buddhism on steroids. The Zen belief is that the unconscious mind, the core of the unconscious mind, is enlightened, is already enlightenment. And so it's not the case that in Zen we are pursuing enlightenment. That is not correct. Feel free to disagree, but I think it's wrong. The teaching is that already at the core of the mind is enlightenment, is this deeply luminous, compassionate awareness, this deep, compassionate, enlightened intelligence. And that it is true that as we're growing up, things happen to us. We suffer injuries. Yesterday, I was talking about the fact that we all have a shadow. We've all suffered these injuries that close us up and make us, fearful, envious, aggressive, and so on and so on. We all have a shadow. We've all suffered injuries, some serious injuries. I mean, like with my uncle, you know, my uncle, his parents were very poor. They were immigrants. You know, they came here with nothing. He wanted to have the world they didn't have, you know, and so he worked very hard and he made a lot of money. And as he was doing this, he really like starved himself, you know. I don't mean he didn't eat. He liked to eat, you know. But he starved himself emotionally, and he starved his wife emotionally. And so, you know, finally they were just like two very lonely people living in a big house in Montclair. And so he had a shadow. He had a shadow self that he didn't confront. You know, so we all have shadows. You know, we all have these shadow selves, and we usually can't allow ourselves to see our shadow either. You know, but the Zen teaching is that at the core of the human being there is this enlightened mind, this radiant, compassionate mind. And that basically it's trying to help us wake up all the time. It's the true teacher. That inside of us, so to speak, it's not really inside of us, but there is at the core of our awareness this luminous, compassionate mind that's like working to help us wake up. And that's the Zen view. And so when we sit, we're trying to get in touch with the inner teacher, the inner guru, you know, and we're trying to allow it to do its work, you know. And it's trying to help us all the time, you know. And sometimes it does things that are a little strange, but it's trying to help. And we're always sometimes fighting, you know, we're fighting. So, you know, when people become depressed, for example, that's the inner guru, that's the inner teacher trying to help. You know, so basically like your inner teacher is saying, you know, you're really working too hard. You have no emotional life. You hardly ever see your spouse. When you get together, she's resentful and is, you know, basically, you know, not pleasant to be around, and you're abusive or something, you know. And then you go and drink, you know. But you know, basically the small mind doesn't want to hear that. It's like, no, I've got to work, you know. So you work. And, you know, basically the big mind, the enlightened mind, is saying, what about love? You know, what about human contact? You know, what about, I've got to work. You know, so you're resisting your Buddha mind. You're not listening to your Buddha mind, and you're tamping it down. You're closing the door. And finally, you know, you get depressed. And this is actually your Buddha mind saying, you know, will you please listen to me? I'm telling you, you've got to have a different life. You know, you've got to live a different way. So even something like depression is this luminous, compassionate mind trying to send you a message that you might be too afraid to get, you know. People might be depressed on and on and on without changing their lives in some way, you know. So Zen is all about having an intelligent heart. Is learning how to be a good listener to the big mind, which can always be trusted, you know. And so, you know, basically you sit on the cushion and you have a koan, and it might be this koan, and you think, you know, you try to solve it intellectually. You say, okay, where are you from? That's a Zen question. I know that from Zen literature, you know. When a teacher says to the monk, where are you from? It's always a Zen question. It's really about your state of awareness. Okay. Mount Rozan. You know, you could look it up. You know, where is Mount Rozan? Have you been to Goroho Peak? You know, is that Vulture Peak? Is that where the Buddha taught? It's a peak. You know, you could interpret it. Kyozan said, no, not yet, said the monk. Kyozan said, oh, you have not visited, you know. So you could try to figure it out, you know. And, of course, anybody who's done Zen for a while knows that this is like a totally inappropriate way to process koans, you know. But that's how we normally approach our lives, right? We normally use this discriminating mind to try to think it through. But on the cushion, we don't do that. We enter deep mushin, which is and that blankness, that darkness that you encounter on the cushion, is quite important. You know, people who don't know anything about Zen, you know, sometimes read books in it. We'll talk about a book like a Glimpse of Nothingness, and you think, oh, nothingness, how depressing. You know, a person who doesn't know Zen might think, oh, that sounds really like a downer. You know, but if you do Zen, you know, and you're watching the breath and you enter this blankness, you realize this is so wonderful, this purifying, energizing. All forgiving darkness, you know, is so marvelous, you know. And you sit in that blankness, and basically the koan begins to work in an unconscious way, you know. It's like an unconscious cue. So the koan has entered your unconsciousness, your unconscious, and it sort of sinks down like a stone sinking into a well. And gradually the water starts to bubble and boil, and something comes to the surface, you know. And you might be working on a koan, and you might think it has nothing to do with your relationship to your brother, you know. You're sitting on the cushion, and suddenly you find yourself in tears, you know? And you realize, oh my God, I have got to call my brother after the sesshin. You know, I saw him at Thanksgiving, and I suddenly realized he said something to me. You know, he was asking for help, and I didn't hear it. You know, or he seemed down, and I didn't pay attention, you know? And so you get on the phone and you say, you know, how's it going? You know, and, oh, I'm good. You're like, I don't think he is good. You know, maybe I'll go see him. You know, so this is like an intelligent heart, right? I mean, you maybe were at Thanksgiving, you saw your brother, you wanted to have a good time. You didn't want to be brought down, you know, so... You know, maybe you didn't pay attention to this cue that he gave you, some message, you know, that said, I'm not so good, you know. But you didn't hear it, you know. So, I mean, we all do this, right, you know. And then you're sitting on the cushion and you suddenly realize, you know, could he have meant this, you know. And then you call him up and you realize, yeah, he has been in some distress and you could, you know, go hiking or something this summer with him and he'd feel a lot better. So this is like an intelligent heart. And being able to access this emotional intelligence is really quite important. We can discover not just things about our brothers, but things about ourselves, you know. So we're thinking, I've got to get to medical school. You know, my mother told me, with her hands raised to heaven, I should be a doctor, you know. And maybe you're sitting on the cushion and you realize, wait a minute, you know. I don't really want to be a doctor, you know. And that could be, you know, that's not an easy decision, right? Because, you know, you have to go, oh, you know, everything I've been told is called into question. My parents are not going to understand, you know. I've spent 6 years, you know, taking all these science courses, you know, and you know, maybe it's not what I want, you know, and then what do I want, you know, and it's frightening, it's terrifying. Probably in the long run, it's much better to listen to that voice, you know. I enjoy sesshin a great deal. And I come to sesshin and sometimes I have a lot of problems, you know. And I can be really tired. And, you know, 4:30 is 4:30 for me too, you know. So, you know, my alarm goes off at 4:15 and I think, oh, brother, this is awfully early, you know. Then I get up, you know, and you know, in the middle of, I must say, you know, I, you know, those morning sits I really love. And I get off the cushion and my heart is just singing. You know, I'm just singing. And I'm so happy. You know, if somebody had asked me 35 years ago, you know, what would make you happy? I never would have said it was this, you know, ever. I thought I would. What would make me happy was being a great novelist, you know. That would make me happy, you know. So, that's what I thought life had in store for me. And life hasn't done any of the things I expected it to do, actually. But what it has done has been really quite wonderful, you know. So, you know, the point is that Zen is like a different way of living. It's a way of living based upon trusting your big mind and accessing it and letting it guide you. And it's scary sometimes. It's scary to do that because it doesn't always tell us what society tells us. And it doesn't even tell us sometimes what we think it should be telling us. You know, so you say, you know, it's almost like you get a message and you think, oh, really? I should do that? No, that's crazy, you know. And so, but probably if you live that way, that, you know, if you live from your intelligent heart, you know, there's an unintelligent heart too, right? You know, so an unintelligent heart looks at an apple pie and says, I love apple pie, and it eats the whole pie, right? That would be an unintelligent heart, right? So that would, you know, and people can't, because they don't have a, you know, Zen is like about having an intelligent heart, an educated heart, right? So because people don't have an educated heart, their fears and their needs get very mixed up. And they do things compulsively and destructively, right? Because they have an unintelligent heart. But Zen practice is about having an intelligent heart. So when we practice being accessible to the big mind, and we learn how to be available to the messages of the big mind, and usually those come in the form of emotional feelings. You know, how do you feel? You know, so if you feel happy, safe, and secure, probably on the right track. You know, if you feel edgy and angry, then you're working with something there that has to be worked through, you know. So the intelligent heart is the goal of Zen. And it means living a different kind of life because it doesn't necessarily fit with what people expect life to be, you know. If you look at the biographies of a lot of Zen masters, at the end of their lives, they often say things that are very interesting. You know, they say things like, my whole life, what a waste, you know? Or, you know, this is classic. That would be a classic Zen, you know, one big mistake after, right? That's a classic, right? You know, Zen will say, oh, one failure on the heels of another, like one great mistake, you know, and so on and so on. You think, oh my God, you know, what's going on with these guys? You know, what are they saying? And this is classic. If you look at Zen literature, this happens all the time. You know, when Lin Ji was dying, he said, oh, you know, my whole life has been a failure, and my student is this guy who, you know, doesn't know up from down. Who would have thought, you know, the Dharma would end with this blind ass? You know? That's what he actually says. You know, and then he dies, you know. So you think, wow, you know, this is, Zen sounds great, you know. That sounds great. One big failure, you know, one mistake after another, you know. See, I mean, I too am afraid of failure. I too am afraid of making mistakes, right? But the Zen masters are saying, I made a mistake after mistake after mistake, and so what? Because I trusted big mind, see? I trusted big mind. I lived hearing the voice of big mind, you know. And that's very hard. That's because, you know, because we do measure, you know, we want to have a life story that, if you read like biographies of quote great men, they're usually so phony, you know. It's like little Henry Ford, little did he know he would invent the American auto industry, but he loved, you know, he loved little toy trucks. There was, you know, they didn't have trucks, but, you know, he loved to play with mechanical things even as a child, right? And it's like, no, life is not like that, right? You know, probably Henry Ford's mother wanted him to be a doctor. He failed out of medical school. He saw, you know, a steam engine. He saw a wagon. It hit him. My God, I could put a steam engine in a wagon, you know. And then I wouldn't have to work. I could get other people to do my work for me, you know. That's how it really happened, right? So life isn't really the story, you know, the narrative. We want to say, you know, it started here and it ended here. There was a smooth development. But, you know, that's just baloney. You know, life isn't like that. Nobody can predict, you know, where they will be in 20 years. It's just impossible, you know. That's a fantasy, you know. So you know, what happens, though, as you get older, and I can speak from experience, is that people measure their lives against these conventional narratives, you know. So, you know, people can say, well, I was in IT too. Why didn't I start Microsoft? You know, oh, what an idiot I am. You know, I could have been Bill Gates. You know, this sort of thing. And this is very destructive. You know, this way of thinking is very, very destructive. If you read the biography of Steve Jobs, I would bet you will be ambivalent, because you're kind of probably happy you're not Steve Jobs after reading that biography. He was not a nice guy, you know, in a lot of ways. Almost ruthless, right? And he had his dark and his light, right? You know, so his life is more complicated than you would think, right? It's not just his life has dark and light, you know. At the end of his life, he had done a lot of damage, and he'd done some good things too, right? When the Zen master is saying, my life was one big mistake after another, what they're really saying is, don't expect life to match these stories people tell about how life should go, because that's artificial. You know, trust your big mind, and you know, basically, if you feel dead and helpless, if you feel joyless and trapped, you're probably not living the way you should be living. And if you're living in a way that makes you feel more alive, more interested, more aware, more compassionate, you're probably living in a better way, right? You know. So learning how to hear the voice of the big mind is really important. Now, you know, people have dark and they have light. So nobody's 100% alert, awake, you know, etc. That would be, you know, our idea of the Buddha, right? Would be somebody who's totally finished in there's no shadow left, right? That would be the Buddha ideal, you know. But in reality, you know, we've got a little of both, right? You know, so we're working to be less dead and more alive, and we're working to be more aware and less unaware, and more compassionate and less uncompassionate, you know, and we're a mix of dark and light, and we're working on it, you know. But the thing is that Zen is all about learning how to work, do that kind of work, and how to be accessible to the big mind, which Zen says can be trusted. You know, we have a lot of neuroses, and we have a lot of baggage that we bring with us that's in the unconscious, you know. So when you're sitting, you do remember, you know, you do realize you have these, like, phobias and so on and so on. That's in the unconscious too, but Zen says, yes, that's true, but at the core of the unconscious, there's this enlightened mind. And when we get in touch with this, we feel great joy, we feel energy, we feel compassion. So basically, what one way to think about what we're doing is cultivating the intelligent heart. And it's not easy, because sometimes it means doing what we think society doesn't want us to do. Sometimes it means confronting obstacles that they're difficult to confront, right? Sometimes in a session you're going to get down in the dumps. You know, you might have a day that's just like a really dark day. You know, and you said I didn't want to be back at this place. You know, but you know that means something. You have to do something to work through that. You know, and you know sometimes a certain day of session. People, you have a day where they, how's it going? It's just terrible. You know, you think, oh, when I first started doing this, as a matter of fact, long, long ago, I started, well, not that long ago, but about 17 years ago, that's pretty long, you know, I started teaching Zen. And, you know, there's no school for Zen teachers. You go through training and my teacher said, do this. And I didn't do it for 8 years, but then I finally did it. And when I first started doing Sashin, about day three, people would come in and I'd go, how's it going? They go, oh, terrible. Terrible. I'm miserable, you know. Oh, you know, I think I might leave, you know. Things have never looked darker, you know. And I thought, oh my God, what a flop I am, you know, all these people. You know, and then like day four, like, how's it going? Oh, great. Wonderful. You know, it's never been better. Everything's bright, you know. Really. And it's like, wow, what happened? You know, you're such a great teacher, you know. Thank you. You know. Yeah, sure. Of course. Yeah. But it's not me. It's the process. I started the session saying, trust the process. You know, people encounter their shadow. And then, you know, at some point they start working it through. And then, you know, they work it through. And, you know, by day four sometime, or day five, you know, or even earlier, you know, they feel they're walking on, you know, air. You know, it's great. So we go through this process again and again. You know, you might encounter your shadow, and then you work it through, and you go home and you feel great, you know, and then, you know, but you still have some shadows. You come back and do it again. And this is like karma hospital, right? This is like making things right in your life. And it's a beautiful path, I think. Kyozan, main subject. Kyozan asked a monk, where are you from? Mount Rozan, answered the monk. Have you ever visited Goroho Peak? Are you in touch with your big mind? Asked Kyozan. No, not yet, said the monk. Kyozan said, well, then you have not visited Rozan. You haven't made the trip yet. You know, your discriminating mind went, but you haven't gone. Later, Umon said, this talk of Kyozan's was falling into the weeds, all out of kindness. Now remember, in Zen, a teacher, you know, when you come into Dokusan and I say, oh, that's very good, I mean it, you know. But that's not the classical Zen style. The classical Zen style is never to compliment anybody, you know. So basically, you know, when Umon says Kyozan's an idiot and he doesn't know what he's doing, he's really paying him a big compliment. So he says, this Kyozan was he was falling into the weeds, you know, he hasn't a clue, you know, meaning he's deeply in touch with his unconscious mind. It's just like the Zen teacher saying, my life was a failure, one failure after another. Secho's verse, falling or not falling, who can tell? You know, don't worry about success or failure. Be in touch with your true nature. Falling or not falling, who can tell? White clouds piling up, bright sun shining down, faultless the left, mature the right. That's like in touch, in the unified mind in accord with the way. Don't you know Kanzan? Kanzan, by the way, is Cold Mountain from our lineage. Don't you know Cold Mountain? He went very fast. Cold Mountain was a government bureaucrat, and he had a good career waiting for him as an administrator, and a lot of honor. Probably a lot of dough, you know. And he went up into the mountains and lived a life writing poetry instead. So basically, he followed his true nature. Okay, don't you know Cold Mountain? He went very fast, 10 years not returning. He forgot the way he had come. In other words, you know, he had a plan, but he followed his true nature. After a while, he couldn't even remember his plan because he was in harmony with the Tao, with the way. So that would be a life of one mistake after another, but a lively, intelligent heart.